Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audio Books' The Learning College. I'm your genial host, Alex P. Linder, and I'll be guiding you through the first half of Chapter 4 of James Mason's Siege today. As always, you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and eventually permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Chapter 4 is Conservatism and the Lost Movement. It begins with three epigraphs from Trotsky, Mao Zedong, and Charles Helter Skelter Manson. How about that? James Mason actually knew Manson. He never met him, but he corresponded with him. Now, the first epigraph is from Leon Trotsky, Lev Bronstein, the Jew, communist revolutionary. There is no justice in bureaucracy for the individual, for bureaucracy caters only to itself. One cannot practice the same bureaucracy as one is fighting against. Next up is Mao. A great revolution requires a great party and many first-rate cadres to guide it. It is impossible to carry through our great revolution, which is unprecedented in history, if the leadership consists of a small, narrow group, and if the party leaders and cadres are petty-minded, short-sighted, and incompetent. Great revolution requires a great party and many first-rate cadres to guide it. Finally, Charles Manson. All you fakers are in for it. I begged you on my knees and you didn't listen, and now I can't hear you. Again, this is about conservatism, Chapter 4. Conservatism and the Lost Movement. 4.1. We're going to do 4.1 to 4.10. El Stupido, 4.1. Page 149 to 173 today on the PDF. The worst critics of the armed struggle are inside the movement. If you want to be told how not to do it, just consult the phony Führers. For some very good reasons do they fear and reject the concept of the armed struggle. It is because you can be a damned total fool in the mass strategy and still live. You cannot be thus in the armed struggle. You can be a complete incompetent and an abject failure in the mass strategy, capital M, capital S, and yet still live to formulate clever and complicated reasons to hide or justify your failure. You can get away with being a faker and a blowhard within the mass strategy, and no one can tell you apart from those who may be sincere. You can eke out a living as a mass strategy mail order fraud, but the armed struggle holds no reward unless made a total success. It is therefore a decidedly uninviting climate for the fakers and the kooks. So again, he's opposing mass strategy with armed struggle. Armed struggle capitalized, mass strategy also capitalized. I've always said that the mass strategy could have been made to work under the proper leadership, such as provided by Commander Rockwell, but the sad and sorry types we see today are incapable of anything except amplifying and expounding upon the intricacies of insanity. They can't even do what they claim to be doing, and so no wonder they have no understanding of the armed struggle. Those stupid idiots who, when thinking in terms of the mass idea, envision marching columns decked out in German uniforms, would naturally also think of a stereotyped Hollywood-style urban guerrilla scenario in regard to the armed struggle. One is as stupid and impossible as the other, except that the former will only get you laughed at, while the latter one will get you killed. They are constitutionally incapable of getting their minds away from stale, sterile, and programmed, obsolete ideas. If this isn't the description of a professional loser, then I don't know what is. If there is one kernel, one basic thread that can be used to sum up the NSLF line of thought, National Socialist Liberation Front, it must be to go for the possible and forget the impossible. The types I've just referred to are also unable to recognize or differentiate between these two things. One has to maintain and strive to increase his grip over reality in order to be able to see and to know what is obvious and therefore where the appropriate course is. At this point, we are dictated to by circumstances and have no real choices. The situation is clear. Those who shrink from reality and go off in search of the unreal give away much about themselves. The situation that is clear is that the deadlock must be broken by any means necessary. The phony Führers, true to form, have it bass-ackwards when they blurt, "Everything for power." In fact, there can be no power other than Big Brother's power as long as Big Brother lives and functions. If we've learned anything in 20 years, we have learned that. From the late 60s to the early 80s is his time here. The revolutionary call is death to Big Brother, and until that time, the only power exerted by our side will come from nowhere else but heroes like Fred Cowan, Joseph Franklin, the men of Greensboro, the 22 killer of Buffalo, etc. In many, if not most of the cases, the sacrifice is an expensive one. But it means action, and only action gains results. The rest is hot air. Let him come right out and state that the most vicious and animal-level struggle can be won without sacrifices. Big Brother's power must be broken by any means necessary. One great man added to that, quote, by any means we can find or invent. The key word is invent. The stupid ones will always take it to mean something classic, something that's been tried. In other words, something Big Brother has long ago predicted that may well be tried and therefore is perfectly ready, willing, and able to deal with. Another great man has said, no sense makes sense. That's a quote. In dealing with the all-seeing, all-knowing, all-powerful Big Brother system, Big Brother may be watching, but is Big Brother comprehending? That was Volume 10, Number 4, April 1981. 4.2, The Numbers Game. It seems like the entire estimation of the movement, not only by the general public, but by the members themselves, has revolved around the question, how many? Earlier, we've spoken of Phase 1, or the days of the old American Nazi Party of George Lincoln Rockwell. In the comparatively short time Rockwell was running things, he made a much bigger splash than have any of his followers, and I can't think of an instance where Rockwell was able to put even as many as 50 uniformed men on the streets for a single demonstration. 100 troopers marched down the middle of Euclid Avenue in Cleveland in the fall of 1973, and the news blackout was such that it hardly made a ripple. The reason goes beyond the paper curtain of the establishment media. It concerns real leadership-type activity, personal dynamism, and true revolutionary spirit. Though we sometimes call ourselves a party, we are hardly that in the same sense as the Democrats or Republicans. For the sake of comparison, however, let's compare ourselves with these two ruling bodies. I can make the comparison very short and sweet. Taken all together, how many millions of members or regular voters can they claim? A lot, certainly. How large is their annual budget? Certainly in the millions. Titularly, they control the country. But with all the fine speeches and good hopes, etc., and with all their apparent power, the country's slide into hell gets more rapid all the time. In truth, they are powerless, for they represent the dead weight of numbers embodied in old habit and inertia. The true issue is quality over quantity. Rockwell had envisioned 3, and at one point even 4, phases to the taking of power in the United States, but he lived only to see the completion of the first of these, breaking the blackout, the news quarantine, and becoming widely known. He himself defined Phase 2 as the gathering of trained, hardened, professional political agitators, such as those the Reds are blessed with in good numbers. As he knew, any idiot can run out and get his face in the newspaper, but to back it up with something positive is another matter. The ill-famed, quote, marginal types, the heroes of Phase 1, have proven a plague to us today. All show and blow, never any real go. The man who claims to be in charge of carrying out Phase 2 has done nothing but retrogress to the point at which things stood in 1973. His idea of Phase 2 was a cadre of mindless yes-men owing loyalty to him personally, and basically going on the Führer principle in the stark absence of a Führer. Instead of building a core for the purpose of fomenting revolution, he didn't even succeed in building a decent personal cult around himself. What came out of this craziness was a thing that was termed the 18-month syndrome. A fresh recruit would come to the party, all set and ready for work, to contribute significantly of himself, to see action and to sacrifice. Instead, he got bullshit. Mainly a lot of silly do's and don'ts, restrictions on how to wear his hair, restrictions on his clothing style, demands for paying exorbitant dues and tithes, which somehow never produced a single result, and generally was relegated to treading water. 99% could stand it for no more than about 18 months, hence 18-month syndrome. The number of precious volunteers lost in this manner could have made up a Revolutionary Corps had they been handled right. That strategy has been self-defeated, and that segment of the movement has been and shall remain numerically and in every other way static. Whether you have 100 or 100,000, it doesn't matter if the strategy is all wrong and if the only authority being exerted is of a negative nature. It is the so-called mass strategy and its promulgators, a strategy based on falsehood that hasn't got a chance. The old party generally could claim about 1,000 adherents, a little less most of the time. Usually when asked by the press or anything else, anyone else, we'd tell them in an answer to the questions of the membership numbers, those who know don't tell, and those who tell don't know. Another snappy comeback to that embarrassing question was, not as many as we'd like to have, but more than they'd like for us to have. That was the old numbers game, all quite useless and ridiculous. Tomasi's NSLF Underground in 1975 had about 4 men, but those 4 men had the Reds and Blacks terrified and crying to the system, which they supposedly hated, for protection. That's because those in the NSLF Underground were men. Tomasi was a leader, and his was an organization. So quality over quantity, real leadership needed. Those who think we need millions or even tens of thousands have no understanding. We don't desire merely to dominate or monopolize in the manner of Democrats or Republicans. We're not content with mere power if it means the continued decline of the white race the way we are seeing it today. We have much more than this to do. Radical programs to be enforced. A huge but rotten system to be gotten out of the way first. Can only be done by a sharp cutting edge, never by muscle-bound bulk. The ruling parties are monstrously huge, fat, and rich, but they are rotten to the core and threaten to pull the country down with them if they are allowed to do so. We are tiny but desperate, and the conditions imposed upon us have made us hard as steel and sharp as razors. Let me just jog your imagination by unequivocally stating that 4 men, properly motivated and determined, could set this country on its ear overnight. And what's more, we don't need to sit about like helpless old ladies and wish it were so. We have them, and more, now. Shall you be with us in grappling with and mastering reality, or will you remain among the useless dreamers and escapists, wishing things were other than what they are? As revolutionaries, we know only one compulsion. Circumstances, as we find them, the way they exist, in short, reality. So revolution is a reality-based business. You may have a plan and you may have intentions, and they may be idealistic or even utopian, but you must pay very close attention to reality if you're going to try to do anything serious. And that was Volume 9, Number 5, September 1980. 4.3, Twilight of the Idiots. I know we're not just whistling up our sleeve because we have come damn close to starting something a number of times in the past 10 years. But each time it always gets derailed by some idiot in a position of influence or control. They don't want to rock the boat too badly for fear of provoking the system. Or that's not exactly the way they think it should be done. Or that practice is uncouth and immoral. Or they don't happen to like this or that person. Or it might cut into their own tiny membership or book sales profit. Or they just can't flat stand to see anyone else get any credit. In 14 years at this, I've encountered only one individual high up that turned out to be a paid agent. And he succeeded in getting 2 people locked up. A feat that the right wing is famous for doing all by itself. But no agent I know of has ever been responsible for fouling up entire efforts, wrecking entire undertakings, whole movements. That's always been the handiwork of the damn fakers and idiots who pass themselves off as leaders. Those who have been around for any time think back to when things were really looking hopeful, when it appeared almost certain we were on the verge of a breakthrough. Mysteriously, it collapsed every time. After having witnessed this on several occasions, I became able to tell when a leader or a group had ceilinged out and was about to crash to bits. A peak was reached by almost accident, which couldn't be held. Built-in incompetence took over, and devastation was the result. I am convinced it has not been the work of agents. For one thing, I've been close to many of these so-called leaders, and I know whereof I speak. They are incapable of team effort, which is the heart and core of genuine organization. Fear, jealousy, paranoia, plain stupidity, you name it. And yet they all want to be Führer. The symbolism has not been an error, it's just that the endemic nuts from the right wing work their way into control positions and proceed to poison everything. The one exception to this since Rockwell was Joseph Tomasi and his NSLF approach. Tomasi's secret was that he essentially stopped talking and started doing. He said that all talk, all discussion was counter-revolutionary. The situation has been talked to death, and still they go on talking. Tomasi also knew the real difference between useless effort and effective action practically applied. It boils down to the real reason the twilight of the idiots exists right now. One generation ago, Rockwell devised a strategy aimed at unseating the Jews and other anti-whites from power in the United States. Notice the use of the term anti-whites back in probably, literally 1980, use of anti-whites by James Mason. So one generation ago, Rockwell devised a strategy aimed at unseating the Jews and other anti-whites from power in the United States. It depended on his phase one, which was to break through the paper curtain that the media had in total force for nearly 20 years previous. It was to let them know that true white leadership did exist, and to be ready for them when the going got rough enough. They were jolted from their slumber and were ready to dump the Democrat-Republican shell game, again, before the internet has gone mass public, 15 years before that, 20 years before that. Rockwell's fledgling American Nazi Party wouldn't have lasted overnight against Bobby Kennedy's Justice Department if the system had been able to pin just one act of terrorism on the party or one of its members. Further, such violent acts in those days were the trademark of the Reds and Blacks, still struggling to attain the foothold they desired. The American people hated these antisocial stunts, and Rockwell couldn't afford to be identified with the enemy. So he was confined to walking a thin red line of legality, to performing dangerous and costly political handstands to attract press attention, and to get himself and his organization known to the American people, and not just a few right-wingers. So that's how hard it was to let people know you're out there before the internet. Rockwell succeeded in this. He went on a college speaking tour, for one thing. And now the generic term of American Nazi Party is universally accepted as a fact of life. Let us now get off that phase and begin doing something with it. The reason the old BS just can't cut it anymore is simply because the old tactics depended totally on sensationalism, and with the national and world situation the way it is, merely waving a swastika is no longer enough. The swastika has, if anything, been overworked and abused. There's been nothing behind it until now. To tell these idiots and fakers that what is now called for as revolutionary action goes over about as well as Hitler at a bar mitzvah. And that is why we are dying on the vine today. Our message can only be convened through action, henceforth, and our actions must be so calculated that they speak clearly for themselves. Volume 9, number 4, August 1980. 4.4, to build a movement. There is no question that there has got to be some form of movement, however rudimentary, already in existence prior to any major disruption in national communication, if we are to hope for any success over all others whose ideology is bound up in the assumption of the continuation of the present system. We have all the elements. It can be done and must be done. If I were to name a handful of the chief bugaboos which have consistently fouled up the many past efforts toward establishing a true movement, one of the primary ones would surely be the perennial phenomenon of the personality clash. Two people, or two or more cliques of people, who just aren't personally compatible, who surely would make for a lousy marriage, but who, in the end, just aren't disciplined or dedicated enough to realize what the hell they are supposed to be doing. Of course, it only takes one half of a personality clash to foul up the entire works and create unnecessary division and, 9 times out of 10, a case of utterly insane fraternal backbiting. A case of two types of people, those too busy doing their jobs to play games, whom others love to seek out as enemies, And those who are so ineffectual at fighting the real enemy, they need to pick on someone more their own size and infinitely safer, i.e. someone in the movement. Now, it may be reasonably argued that, in reference to the latter group, anyone so terminally stupid as that can't legitimately be thought of as being part of the movement. It may sound logical, but it is too easy. Too easy because it takes in most of those who make up the present movement. So at second glance, one answer appears to me: a form of elitism, as distinctly opposed to snobbery, by which those among that former group mentioned in the above paragraph, after identifying one another positively, get together on a cordial yet working basis and take concrete steps to guard themselves and their efforts against the idiotic machinations of the latter group, which could perhaps more accurately be looked upon as a misplaced and mutinous rank and file with completely false pretenses to leadership. In other words, exercise their unified superiority, take the direction and control of the movement out of the hands of the second group, and, through proper techniques of organization and management, put the rank and file types back to work where they belong. The breakdown in leadership has gone on for too long and is having the effect of wearing down the movement in all areas for lack of direction. The time has come for the actual natural leadership of the movement to, of their own initiative, come together and actually form that much talked of leadership cadre, the first of many to come, and put this movement on track to make something of it. That was volume 11, number 2, February 1982. 4.5, Boys from Brazil. Last month I had the dubious opportunity of seeing the film by that name, which took enormous, stupendous liberties with the identity of a still-living person, Dr. Joseph Mengele, by placing him as a central character, played by Gregory Peck, in a fictitious Hollywood potboiler and actually killing him off in the film. Never before have I seen this done. Not to get off my main subject, but to draw an important parallel, how many of you have seen, heard, or read about Mrs. Doris Tate's national campaign to deny parole to those members of the Manson family involved in the killings of 1969? And he puts family and Manson family in quotes, to make it problematic and question it. Major national tabloids have given her full-page coverage and have even supplied coupons for people to sign, clip, and mail to the California Parole Authority. Never before. Double standard, I guess. But as screwy as the plot of The Boys from Brazil was, i.e. the cloning of dozens of Adolf Hitlers in the modern world, in a film made not very many years ago, what the movement itself has been doing for over 20 years is even screwier. Thinking that by dressing and acting like Hitler, that similar results as his might be gained. There are those who deck themselves out, not in serious, dignified National Socialist attire, but in authentic World War II German costumes, complete with decorations, awards, and insignia rank of that period. I don't know which is worse, rendering themselves utterly ridiculous, or insulting the memory of genuine heroes. We have those who sport Hitler hairdos and mustaches, and no fewer than at least one individual in the U.S. South who actually bills himself as Adolf Hitler Jr. And people wonder where the term lunatic fringe comes from. Worse and more destructive than the obvious clowns that no one takes seriously are the, quote, poor men's Hitlers, those who take themselves seriously and those who are taken seriously by the movement as leaders. Names need not be mentioned. Worse still is the actual syndrome I have often witnessed of those totally inferior and unworthy types who try and pattern themselves off these very same overblown losers, all in the name of ego caressing. With this as a general condition, it can be no wonder why the movement is in a mess. And this has been one of the biggest mistakes that I long ago swore to have nothing to do with in any of my own dealings. It is perhaps the easiest to spot, as it is the easiest to steer away from all the common pitfalls. The problem is it forces you out in search of fresh human resources, as it will automatically eliminate 99% of the existing movement as the hobbyists, weirdos, freaks, and geeks that they are. That was volume 12, number 4, April 1983. 4.6, Lessons Learned the Hard Way. Among the areas for greatest attention this time, if old errors are not to be repeated, would be the scrupulous avoidance of another ego cult built around another self-styled Führer. Instead of being any sort of requirement, it has proven to be a deadly liability. With each man at his proper post, doing his utmost without fanfare, it will soon enough become clear whether we have in our presence a true leader of leaders. Until such time, we can do extremely well by maintaining a correct chain of command, seniority of those with proven track records, authority with responsibility based on ability to perform and gain results. There are many effective ways we can operate and go forward while at the same time developing and bringing true leadership to the fore. When we speak of independence, we primarily mean functional independence, so that no one is crying out for this or that, no one carries an unfair load, but most importantly, that no one gets too much strategic control. One of the worst mistakes made in 1976, which I personally walked into with my eyes wide open, as I knew I was taking a calculated but necessary risk, was depending on outside sources for our printed propaganda. This is especially the case with regular publications, as it puts far, far too much control into hands whose sole function is to be at the beck and call of the political leadership of the movement, rather than expecting to play the part of a mastermind because they happen to own press equipment. I repeat, anyone who enters into an arrangement of this nature treads on dangerously thin ice and gives up a very large measure of true independence. Outsourcing your printing, I guess. Each unit of any size must have its own private source of creating its printed propaganda. Each unit of any size must have its own private source of creating its printed propaganda. Again, this is pre-internet. Another error to be avoided this time is excessive splintering, the kind which we saw in 1976 and 1977. When the NSPA, the National Socialist Party of America, was taken out of the parent group, the NSWPP, it provided an alternative for those favoring the mass strategy idea. When Tomasi took the NSLF faction out of the NSWPP in 1974, he created the first group of National Socialists committed to armed struggle. And both of these were based in major U.S. cities. But it was no time before things started taking on a definitely kooky disposition when any disgruntled supporter in Podunk Hollow who had a P.O. box was trying to get into the act with weird-sounding names and even weirder-looking uniforms. That's dissipation, and it is no good. These neighborhood NS circles rightfully should serve as the meat and muscle to the brain and nervous system of the bona fide NS centers. They should not go off in their merry way and become drains that sidetrack critically needed centralized funds and nationally coordinated activities. During 1976 and 77, there was an absolute dearth of mutual honesty and respect, which, once the initial monkey wrenches got tossed into the works, led to the rapid collapse of the entire structure. There was no true loyalty. Once the first opportunist played his hand against one legitimate segment of the movement, and because he owned printing presses, the rest bent completely over backward in futile and disgusting pleas for reconciliation, instead of demanding loyalty first to their own. That attitude of screw you, buddy, for some material advantage, or screw your buddy for some material advantage, real or imagined and at a high price, is what provided for the quick dismantlement of what little had been built up in that short time. There has got to be absolute loyalty to a higher ideal, and that ideal must be that which will carry the movement to power over the state. It must be correctness and not short-range opportunism, egoism, or materialism. Hitler talks a lot about correctness in Mein Kampf. If correctness were in any way bound up in how much money or how many assets a group or individual has, then the Zionist capitalist would have us dead to rights. One line that did arise from the 1976-77 period was, function before form. The only way to do away with rivalries is to outline at the start the true function and purpose in everything, from groups to officers to publications, etc. At the same time, we will increase our potential by the specialization of distinct branches of operation, such as the political, the paramilitary, and the administrative. We cannot tolerate any longer a dozen or so jacks of all trades and masters of none, each purporting to be a leader and have a group, and each getting in the way of the other so that no one gets anywhere. Through true specialization of both function and purpose, we will put an end to the idiotic syndrome of all chiefs and no Indians, and shall then raise the beginnings of a real political army. Not everything associated with the old concept of national headquarters should be completely rejected. For one thing, I'm a believer in uniformity because it builds unity and esprit de corps and looks impressive as hell to all outsiders. Hand in hand must come discipline, without which there is nothing remotely resembling a true and effective organization. We want no more clown costumes passing for NS uniforms, and we want no more generalissimos whose sole function has been to underscore and reinforce disunity and provide gaming material for self-appointed shrewdies waiting to play chess with live figurines. A straight brown and black paramilitary uniform, as defined in 1973, remains the best and most practical way to go for any National Socialist. For the rest, we are so damn small and tightly knit that any further distinction or rank shall be found in the name and face of the wearer of this simple uniform and the reputation he has built by his actions. May we see a return to dignity and sobriety in this manner. Because there are two major divisions in the movement, mass strategy and armed struggle, notice should be served that those who want to wear the uniform should look the part. Those who would instead rather remain indistinguishable from the masses for purposes of being part of the underground had better be ready to act the part. Because now we must base our reliance upon inner discipline in order to get this movement onto the kind of footing it must have before discipline can be enforced externally. Until we are able to properly and competitively pay a professional full-time staff, and until we are confident enough of ourselves to effectively punish transgressors, we must rely upon our own self-discipline if we are to go forward. This calls for certain intelligence, certain maturity, certain commitment. For those who in the least way aspire to any leadership role in the movement, then it also requires a certain self-denial, a placing of the movement above one's own self. Volume 10, number 12, December 1981, that was. 4.7 in reverse. It's gotten to sound like an old cliche to say that the right wing has been going about things backwards, but upon real examination, that turns out to be precisely the case. Blueprints for successful revolutionary movements have been set down for us from Hitler to Rockwell to Tomasi and any number of other great revolutionaries not of the National Socialist spirit. Why then has the movement continued to attach itself to the decrepit and utterly ridiculous right wing and have chosen a course that has perennially doomed itself to failure? In the monumental classic film of inspiration, Triumph of the Will, Hitler says words to the effect that, in our belief and our overview, we must be rock hard, but in our tactics, we must always be flexible. The essence of genius is the ability to spot the super obvious principles of life, things so obvious that the majority can't see them, and to put them into as few simple words as possible. Hitler did that when he made this observation of revolutionary procedure. But the right wing would rather dress up like him and go on about things dead backwards than heeding his words from the start. It's been a case in the past of the two approaches of totality and flexibility misapplied and misdirected, quite literally inverted, in a strategy and overview tailor-made for defeat, which can only be termed, quote, out of this world. When a person or group flies in the face of established and proven principles, the results are entirely predictable. I came to see the predictability of it all long before I was able to figure out why it was so. Never for an instant did I doubt the truth of the cause, and never did I relent in my hatred of the system. At first, one was almost compelled to state that the entire movement was made up of idiots and born losers as being the reason for all the flat, dismal failures of such a noble cause in the midst of such a dire situation. But wait. The system and the establishment are loaded with the same kind of fools and retards and, as far as the power structure is concerned, are doing quite nicely. We've got our share of real bums, but that, however, is not the explanation. The leadership up till now has been responsible for the failure, as leadership, or lack of it, always is, and a great deal of these people were and are highly educated, formerly professional men, who could compare quite favorably against most system bureaucrats with regard to personal ability and qualifications. But it matters not how brilliant or well-trained you are, how many good people you have, or how hard you work, you all work and sacrifice, if your basic premise is off. And it is that above all other causes for the consistent right-wing failure over the decades. Their basic premises were wrong. I'll attempt to examine exactly why it is. The right wing, which includes most of what I call the movement, fights its battles with the system on a piecemeal basis, choosing a cause, an issue, a crusade, here and there. It's always a lost cause going in, and by the time the movement gets its teeth into the meat of it, something new has come along. They actually play poor runner-up to the shell gaming of the system media. At the same time, movement groups go after their members with a raging demand for total conformity to a pattern that is unreal and a call for perfection in their human material. Regulation haircuts, clothing standards, minimums of worthless literature to be bought and presumably distributed, a certain percentage of their income to be pledged, wasted, each month, demonstrations, ridiculous, to be staged minus the necessary personnel to do it right, and minus a public which gives a damn. Plus, I should add, strict adherence to the Führer Prinzip, regardless of what any non-Nazi may wish to call it. To even question is an automatic out. Is this not about the size of it? A revolutionary organization would do it the other way around. To a revolutionary, there are no issues, no campaigns. The only concern is the destruction of the existing order, the existing power. In complete truth, most, if not all, of the issues the movement has wasted its time and effort coming out against in the past are some of the very things which will help destroy the hated system. From Vietnam to drugs to abortion to busing to illegal immigration, etc., they have willingly adopted the losing side of the issue. The system is historically doomed, and these things are just a part of the tide of destruction that is going to engulf it. Sure, a bunch of Jews may be cashing in on it, as they have historically done, but so what? Of course we all know the reason that the movement has taken the stance it always has in the past, because these things were all bad for the white people, and through our public demonstrations against these things, we hoped and expected to gain massive white support for our cause. This strategy never, at any time, has even come close to working. The movement has been indulging in a lot of wishful thinking, and very basically has been thinking with its heart, emotionally. A revolutionary thinks strictly with his brain, his highest intelligence, with regard for practicalities alone. A revolutionary also assumes a vastly different approach to the matter of human resources. This is not the future, this is the present. Even as Robert Lloyd once commented to me in 1969, not a single one of us is even a reflection of the kind of person we want to see inhabit the planet in centuries to come. To go even further, there's no use even worrying about it or trying to fake it. Rather, work for the fall of the monster system that, if it keeps itself in power indefinitely, will spell the absolute end for any hope of a better future. That is primary. Nothing can be done for our people as long as the system lives and exerts its influence. Now I ask you, what kind of clean-cut, moral, law-abiding, and upstanding citizen, that's in quotes, does it require to tackle a job like that? The great Russian anarchist Bakunin described the qualifications well. The lost man who has no belongings, no outside interests, no personal ties of any sort, not even a name, possessed of but one thought, interest, and passion, the revolution. A man who is broken with society, broken with its laws and conventions, he must despise the opinions of others and be prepared for death and torture at any time. Hard towards himself, he must be hard on others, and in his heart there must be no place for love, friendship, gratitude, or even honor. That's a revolutionary. As for leadership, Tomasi put it best when he wrote that the leaders are those who are doing it. Those with backgrounds in National Socialism reaching back more than a decade will recall the so-called leader who ousted Tomasi from the party for being, quote, too revolutionary, for having had women in the headquarters, horrors, for having had marijuana in the headquarters, more horrors, for using the system in order to strengthen the revolutionary organization, unethical, and for attacking the system, destroying it physically and materially. Illegal. It's only been 10 years since his death, and the blossoming of the full-scale revolution may yet be a long ways away, but his name is remembered and known in more quarters than the, quote, leader who dismissed him. The only totality we can apply currently with success is in our view toward the system, is in our own view toward the system, the enemy. When we attempt to apply it to new people, new adherents to the movement, we achieve only an inward-looking cult. We alienate good people who are committed but still of a level-headed, reasoning nature. We open the field for nuts and tinhorns who are willing to put up with and even add to the nonsense in order to be a bigger part of it and, worst of all, we stifle fresh genius. It is a low view, held only by those who can't handle the enemy and choose instead to tyrannize the membership and make people over while pretending to attack small surface symptoms of a far more serious problem and falling flat even at that. In applying a strategy of totality toward the system instead, we find ourselves keeping up a constant pressure against it where it counts. On a never-ending day-to-day basis, we begin to lay the groundwork for a truly popular front and rid ourselves of the label of kooks, reactionaries, and fascists. We develop a true ideology, a worldview, and in living it rather than playing at it, we eventually become larger, greater than the enemy itself. We assume the advantage, the offensive, and through our self-discipline and diligent efforts, we become the embryonic government to be, more than worthy and capable of taking over the reins once the present government is gone. To the opposite side, the only area in which we can afford to be flexible is that of our own people. The system is ruthless, unfeeling, unrelenting, and so we must be toward it. We are our only best hope. We are our only best friends. We are all that we have, and it would behoove us all to take better care and have better regard in our mutual dealings. Decency, intelligence, and plain practicality when applied to new people, and current ones as well, would result in the attraction of new talent and better exploitation of existing talent. It would encourage initiative. It would encourage greater overall loyalty. And through the feeling of community, it would make us far less vulnerable to system attacks. Only through these means will we be able to enjoy and employ the equally primary principles of selection in building an effective movement. Only through the dealing with larger numbers, by not driving them away, can we develop the levels of action and leadership necessary to a revolutionary movement. The best will discipline themselves and work harder and meet with greater success. The rest will serve to augment these successes. When, as it has been, the movement imagines it can assume a flexible stance and approach to the vicious beast that is the system, then a system of directionlessness, aimlessness, and general confusion reigns. The system calls every shot. No one knows what's next. There is a lack of seriousness, of real purpose, not to mention an unending series of defeats. Because of this, there develops the clubism, conservatism, reaction. The group is, in effect, a part of the establishment, and because there is no real long-range attack plan, it becomes full of dabblers. Flexibility, when applied to the aim, absolutely precludes decisive action. And a lot of idealistic hopes do not constitute an aim. Revolutionary discipline must mean that we will be the single survivor in a war against the system, a total war against the system. Revolutionary lenience must mean that we will gladly accept the help of all who are willing to work and to fight. We will enlist the help of all. That's volume 14, number 9, September 1985. 4.8, where history stopped. It never hurts to possess a comprehensive understanding of history and the development of Aryan culture, not to mention that of our enemies. This, however, requires much time and study, that is, assuming one can even get hold of the required literature for such study. For purposes of revolutionary understanding, as well as revolutionary recruiting, all that needs to be comprehended well are the occurrences of the past century. It's all contained there within the span of a few short generations. The fall of the white race from the very heights of power and culture to the bottom depths of servitude and degradation. And then, of course, there is the greatest story ever told, which still lies within the memories of half the people yet alive today. That is the saga of Adolf Hitler, the birth and rise of the NSDAP, and the Third Reich in Germany. There, compressed within an incredibly short time frame, 25 years, is the total revelation of an entire age of man. Truly where history, as it had been known since the end of classical civilization, came to its end. To go even further, a person who is truly aware really needs to go to look no further than what he finds around him here in the present day. That may be asking a bit too much, as practically all living vestiges of a great past have been erased. Still, I hold that a person who is strong and natural within will know by the filth and disease all about him that things are not right, and will be able to arrive at his own conclusions, also based on who is running the show and who it is they most curse. Charles Manson, to be sure, has never cracked open one of the right-wing books about the Illuminati, etc., and his grasp of things is total, and how the establishment curses him. Indeed, as he himself points out, books can be dangerous, as they have the power to suck one into them and the era and place they are representing. How true this has been of the entire right wing. If they haven't been living in 1933, they've been living in 1865. I've seen too many who flaunt their prowess at talking right-wing trivia and laying claim to this intellectual trick as some kind of grounds for leadership. Some of it might be of interest for a genuine student of history, as I am, who doesn't mind lectures, but it is counterproductive in the extreme where revolutionary personalities and temperaments are involved, that is, among the more directly action-minded. They want to hear present-day reality put into simple terms of explanation. They want to hear flaming, living rhetoric to forge together a hardcore movement, and most of all to hear about the future, not the past. Just as not everyone was ever intended, at least not by nature, to fall into the system's universal, compulsory liberal education, not everyone who might possibly gravitate into the movement is intended to be aware of everything that has happened throughout history, from antediluvian times to the present. For all but the most tiny few, such knowledge is useless baggage. The fact is that most couldn't care less. To try to push it on them is to alienate and lose them. Give them instead what will most set them on fire, the way to deal with the present rather than be victimized by it, and most of all, the way to conquer the future. Volume 13, Number 6, June 1984. 4.9. What we can dispense with. We can unburden ourselves of all useless wreckage and lumber. Things like idle complaint. We cannot complain about what's going on. We can only complain about ourselves, as yet not having reached a point where we can do something about it. Right now, we'll do very well to concentrate on ourselves, for until we have done that, we can't do much about anything else. It is an error to complain about politicians. It is a worse error to complain about any specific politician by name. That is because to do so is to extend to them a certain legitimacy, and at the same time to go so far as to place yourself in the same league, on the same level with them, as though they are your leaders and you don't approve of what they're doing. To fall into, or more often to fail to get out of this line of thought, is fatal 100% of the time, and no one who has ever towed a line like that has ever succeeded at anything. As to what the Jews are up to, what the blacks have pulled lately, etc., it is all the same. People in groups will do as it is their nature and will to do. They cannot be predicted to do as might be expected when a society is broken down as this one has. Anyone who cannot see this has no business whatsoever in any movement calling itself politically revolutionary. The enemy is the enemy, and aliens are aliens. All politicians, high and low, are pigs in a pig system. If they weren't, they wouldn't be there. From president to dog catcher, they are all the same bureaucratic sellout swine. No distinctions are to be drawn. Meaningless considerations of parties, of left and right, and even individual identities, names, etc., are simply not to be used. To kill an ism, you have to kill the ists. Their words and actions are absolutely predictable, and no one should ever express any sense of shock or outrage at them. We must view them as a mountain range, or a fetid swamp, or a series of storm clouds. Just there. A factor to be noted and taken into account, upon which to base future strategy, In the present, we have to work around them, in spite of them, never extending to them the invitation to send in their pigs to break us up, to break up these, our most early and rudimentary efforts. In the future, we have to break up their power base and unseat them from the positions of authority which they usurp from real American leaders who haven't existed now in several generations. In the end, we have to simply kill them, as expeditiously and unceremoniously as possible. As for what any black or group of blacks may do, likewise with any alien congregations, it should concern us not. For this is not our country, and these are not our people. They are not doing anything to us, not taking anything away from us. They are but players in a common chessboard. They are merely aliens on this continent, which has mostly seen throughout its existence the parlances of groups of aliens, vying one against another for greater dominance. There is no indication that this long-established trend will not go on. If anything, they serve to unsettle and unhinge the drive for total control by the big brother pig bureaucrats of the system. At this point, anything which contributes to the friction, chaos, and anarchy can only help us in the long run. Should we then express any particular shock when any member of these alien groups commits some transgression against the old Anglo-Saxon laws which, once, long ago, were devised to govern this land? Outrages and offenses to the sensibilities of any truly civilized individual have long since become the rule and not the exception. We must view it merely as the element in which we swim, in which we struggle. And of course, as we all know, it continues to degenerate further with each passing year. You do not complain about this. You either choose to swim or not to swim. You adapt to it so as to be able to function most effectively in it. You don't have to like it. You never accept it. But you view it as the only primary aspect of a greater game plan in which everyone is caught up. Others will view it differently, but they will be deluding themselves. You don't worry about any of that. You only worry about what you are going to be doing next on your own in relation to it. I think that's one of the better ones in the whole set that we've gone through so far in the book. Very. Don't get caught up in the particularity, see the general picture. The whole system has to be destroyed, and that's it. And what are you going to do about it? You see, as opposed to Trump this, Trump that, the Jews this, blacks that. Something very much to think about. That was volume 13, number 6, June 1984. And now on to the last one in this set, 4.10, Reasons, Not Excuses. We have ourselves to attest to the fact that no one has to submit to the tyranny that today reigns. Who and what did it for us? The answer is no one and nothing. We did it ourselves, individually. We did it even though our backgrounds at that early time were practically identical to any of the rest, even though we were educated in the same school system, watched the same movies and television, read the same books, newspapers, and magazines. We existed in the same world as the rest, and yet we broke away. Why don't they? The reasons why no mass movement has existed in this country on the part of whites to defend themselves and what is theirs have been extensively dealt with by movement scholars, probably more than any other single topic. There, of course, is the media brainwash, which not only denies all truth, but pumps the head full of lies and poison and robs the thinking and decision-making processes of any chance to function. There is the comfort corruption which softens and saps the will and spirit. Then there is also dysgenics, which means, though a person is nominally white, he is so only in color. There is nothing underneath. This is the product of fratricidal wars and total lack of breeding, the creation of a race of boobs. These are some of the reasons. They may help us to understand, but they excuse no one. The old movement used to actually take comfort and reassurance from all of this and kept telling itself that all would be put right when der Tag, the day, arrived. It won't. It means that 9,999 out of 10,000 have been culled out of the action and have succumbed to things intended to consume all of us, but which were escaped by a tiny few. The theory that all will be well once we have blazed the path or when things get bad enough is misguided. No one will, quote, come along once it has been seen that the going has been made safe and secure, because it will never become such until the last fire has been extinguished, the last shot fired, the last body buried. And that was volume 13, number 3, March 1984. And that will end our segment for today. Thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll finish up chapter 4 on conservatism from James Mason's Siege.